Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. Again, you know, more building, scaling, financing, all of that good stuff that we like to hear, you know, with the founder that we have today joining us. He's running a rocket ship, you know, as we like them. And we're going to be talking about early experience, for example, what it was for them to go through Y Combinator. Also, what was the experience of finding product market fit early on, as well as to how to think about scaling and emotions, you know, that you got to go through in order to make it work. But again, really, really inspiring conversation ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest, Ulrik Stig Hansen. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Alejandro. Excited to be here.
So originally, you were raised right outside of Copenhagen. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, that's right. So I grew up in a small town outside of Copenhagen, which admittedly was the most conducive environment for an aspiring AI founder. But there weren't too many distractions around there. So I got into coding early on and probably spent the better part of 5 years just kind of coding, working on different projects, perfecting my skill set, which, you know, have been very important, I think, to my journey as a founder, given that I had that early kind of experience in building products and talking to users and all that good stuff.
So what do you think got you hooked into coding so early on?
Well, I think coding is, you know, it's a very interesting discipline in that you can build things from your, you know, bedroom, which I don't think you get in any other kind of like discipline. So I really like the problem solving aspects and the building aspects. And if you combine those two, I think you can like spend days, you know, just like pondering over a problem and like just get stuff out that you can have people use within like very short periods of time, which I don't think is the case for any other thing that you could do with your time.
So what was that journey to get to JP Morgan?
Yeah, so, you know, I really liked building stuff and I knew that I wanted to start a company one day. So I naively thought that I had to get experience working in business and finance to get there. So I moved to London in my early 20s to start my career there. I think I had a great time, learned a lot of things, but ultimately, when you work in a big corporation, right, I think any corporation, you don't really get hands-on building stuff. And I always wanted to get back to building. So I stuck around there for a few years, but ultimately decided to leave to found Encore eventually.
And before that, you know, you were getting, you know, started on the AI, that excitement around AI, which, you know, obviously ended up getting you to Imperial, which is an incredible university where you did your master's in computer science. But what was so appealing to you about AI and what was going on in the space?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think when I did my computer science master's at Imperial, that was right around the time when the Transformer model came out, the first YOLO model came out, the GPT-2 model came out from OpenAI in like 2019, I think. So the interesting thing was that these models that had been, I think, very much confined to like academic research were actually starting to deliver value in the real world. For, I think, the first time. So AI, of course, like have had a few false starts and it didn't quite live up to the hype of the past. So that was incredibly exciting, I think, to see from the sidelines. If you kind of looked ahead, it was very clear that we were on the precipice of a major technological platform shift. And I think I would like be very sad to miss that, because I think anyone who's grown up during the kind of early days of the internet and have been in kind of, you know, in entrepreneurship or is excited about starting a company, always felt that we missed out on the internet revolution. So I just couldn't miss out on the AI revolution.
So how do you end up meeting who ended up becoming your co-founder at Encore?
So I met Eric, my co-founder, at an entrepreneur network in London. Eric had just left his job. He worked in high-frequency trading. He was working on big data systems, putting thousands of models into production to, of course, I do different things. I trade stocks, futures, and ETFs. But we saw the world in very much the same way, in that the data part of the AI development stacks, the AI you need models, compute, and data to get working. There was a huge opportunity just because the innovation of the past couple of years had not been what we had seen for models and compute. So we thought there was an incredibly exciting opportunity. And that's really why we started Encore.
So what ended up becoming Anchored for the people that are listening to get it? What is the business model? How do you guys make money?
Anchored started off as focused on data annotation. So when we went out and started Anchored at the beginning, we talked to probably like 1,000+ AI engineers, researchers, ML engineers, data scientists, and they all like basically said the same thing, which was that they were having a really hard time getting the best data annotated to use in their models. I think since then, like the problem has shifted somewhat from being a data quantity problem into being a data quality problem. So, you know, instead of getting like high quantities of data, people are now much more focused on getting the right data into their production AI systems. So we've really built Anchored to solve that entire workflow from solving the data quantity to the data quality problem, breaking down the problem into three distinct pieces. So data management curation, getting the right data, annotation, so having humans provide feedback to the model, and then model evaluation, so making sure that you are pushing the right data into the model and taking all the data out of the model that might be poisoning the data set or hurting your model performance.
So what was that the journey of going through Y Combinator? Because there's a lot of people that are probably listening, thinking about, you know, the whole accelerator thing or incubator thing. So at what point do you guys realize, hey, you know, like maybe it makes sense to go to San Francisco, to join Y Combinator, to become part of that community? How was that thought process? And then also, what was the experience like of going through Y Combinator?
We went to YC in the winter of 21, which is just more than just over 3 years ago. It was a very odd time because it was during the depths of the COVID pandemic. So all of our YC experience was fully remote. And I'm sure that in-person experience is much better. I think for a first-time founder, you probably can't find a program or an accelerator that helps you avoid as many mistakes as YC does. So when you're first getting started, you may like not think about fundraising the right way. You might not think about finding product market fit in the right way. And I think the YC network really helps you hone in on like the things that are important and prevents you from spending too much time on things that are less important to, you know, initially finding product market fit, getting your first customers, and beginning to scale out some of your product engineering teams initially.
So then coming out of Y Combinator, what was that like? Because it was kind of like a rocket ship too, especially the way that things started to happen too on the financing front. So what was that like coming out of there?
Y Combinator, I think, has probably one of the best fundraising kind of like environments attached to it. So YC definitely helps you a lot with getting the initial capital in. I think, you know, the common misconception is like that's by no means a given. You really have to work hard, I think, to get the investors that you want and to get that initial capital in. I think YC really helps with that, but they can like solve the problem for you, of course. Coming out of YC, we raised in a very hot funding environment in 21. So we raised a pre-seed, a seed, and a series A in 21, which really gave us the capital that we needed to build out the initial product engineering team, build out a great product that we could sell repeatedly to our customers, and also afforded us the luxury of, you know, making a few mistakes, I think, on the side of finding product market fit side, and also the initial scaling of the team.
So then talk to us about how that fundraising journey was. I mean, how much capital have you guys raised to date?
We have raised $50 million. We just closed a $30 million Series B a couple of months ago with Next 47, with participation from Y Combinator, CRV, our seed and Series A investor, and also a bunch of other great investors that we've been very excited to get on board. I think the common mistake that people make is that they take fundraising lightly, and they kind of like take it for granted that they'll be able to raise money, especially being an AI company. And I could just tell the audience that that is definitely not the case. It is extremely difficult. The Series B market is still, I think, reeling from a bit of an overhang from the boom years. So I think the most recent round was definitely the most difficult one to raise. But, you know, I think we managed to get it done. We managed to get some great investors on board. And we have now a lot of capital for the next phase of the Anchored journey, which we're incredibly excited about.
And we'll talk about that in just a little bit, but It was very impressive, the fact that you guys were able to do the pre-seed, seed, and Series A in like such a short amount of time. Why was that the case?
Yeah, that's right. So back then in 21, this was like pre-ChatGPT days, right? So AI was still sort of like something that people were like peripherally interested in, but it wasn't the main thing that people were going after. I think back then, like crypto and blockchain, I think was very much like the thing that was like hot amongst investors. But I think we had an insanely compelling pitch even at the time, where, you know, you could kind of see that the AI boom was like right on the way or ready to take off. We'd already gotten our first like initial set of customers. We worked with some of the world's leading AI teams, both at like big enterprise, but also like AI scale-ups. We already had some of those customers early on, given the insane customer focus that we've had. So we really built the product to support those kinds of use cases. And I think we were quite lucky to find a set of investors who really believed in that vision and decided to back us pretty early on when the team was like still pretty small.
Because what was the timeline, you know, between pre-seed, seed, and Series A? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so I think pre-seed we raised in like February. That was like the Y Combinator check. The seed round we closed in May, and the Series A we announced in early October. So it was a very, very short timeline. I think that year was pretty crazy. Like we ultimately to spend most of our time, or not most of our time, but a lot of our time conferring with our legal counsel and and whatnot to get the rounds done. But ultimately, you know, it gave us the firepower that we needed to get to initial scale and raise a Series B this year.
Yeah, because typically people think more like 18 to 24 months between financing cycles. What was your guys' thought process behind, hey, you know what, let's go at it again with another financing for the pre-seed, seed, and Series A all within such a short period of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, we were very lucky to get some amazing customers and amazing logos on board pretty early on. And we kind of like knew already at the time, like what we wanted to build. So for us, it was really a function of like, how quickly could we move on accelerating our product roadmap to get to build those pieces of the product that we wanted to. And ultimately, like more cash gives you the flexibility to like hire more people and move faster. And that's ultimately like what we ended up doing.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And how different was that year, you know, of doing early stage stuff, you know, versus the Series B, which is more like growth stage stuff? I mean, it's quite a transformation going from early stage to growth stage. So how different did you find the process of going through the Series B?
Extremely different. Early stage is all about like vision. I think it's very little metrics driven. Of course, like you have to have some customers or like some use cases to kind of back it up when you go out and pitch to make sure that like investors can even believe the vision that you're selling. I think Series B, early growth stage, is when things start to get more metrics driven. So you start to look more at different like types of SaaS metrics like CAC, payback periods, account executive ramp times, on like efficiency metrics, gross margins, and these sorts of things that will matter even more for later stage rounds, where let's say that early stage is 90% vision, 10% metrics. I think Series B is probably somewhere like 60-40 or 50-50 vision and metrics. And when you move to like Series C and beyond, the pendulum kind of switches in the opposite direction, where it's 30%, 20 to 30% vision and, you know, 70% metrics.
So then it sounds like you guys found product market fit very quickly. What was that moment where you were like, I think that we're into something here?
Finding product market fit is always like an interesting thing, right? Because I don't think there was like a singular moment when we experienced like, oh, now things are growing extremely rapidly. I think it's a series of events that just end up happening. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I'm the founder and I'm no longer involved in every single deal anymore. So now when I see deals close, and I think this is actually the moment where I thought, okay, we have product market fit, was when our sales team started closing deals that I had no idea like what those companies were doing. And I think that's quite a special moment for a founder. It's kind of like, you know, having code that almost like writes itself when you see that happening, because it means that you have built some repeatability into your sales motion, and that the next challenge for you probably is going to be figuring out like, how do we scale that up?
So then when you're thinking more about the growth stage where you guys are at now, you know, how do you go about, how have you guys found, you know, that comfortable situation, or maybe not comfortable, but really the path to follow, you know, that was more on the scale side, and what were going through, what was like going through those motions to make it work?
People, I don't think, like, talk enough about scaling a company. They talk a lot about finding product market fit, and I think scaling a company is like probably equally difficult, if not more difficult, than finding product market fit. This is probably a function of the air gets thinner the longer you get in the journey. So for like some of the even later stage YC companies, know the founders there, you know, they don't have many peers that can actually like ask questions from. So that becomes like being the biggest challenge. I think for us, you know, the challenge now is really finding enough qualified people on the go-to-market side that can sell a technical product to a technical buyer in what is still a pretty early market. And I think that's, you know, been one of the main challenges of us, is that just finding enough high quality salespeople that can help us run the sales function and like run the deals like pretty much autonomously.
So then also for you guys now, you know, you've also, we're talking about scale. So I want to talk about scaling people, because in the last year, you guys have grown, according to LinkedIn, by about 36%, the employee count, and in the last 2 years by about 112%. So how do you think about two scaling when it comes to people, when it comes to culture, so that it doesn't break?
It's an incredibly difficult thing to get right, I think. So we have very much focused on scaling the team or our headcount in a profitable way. So not throwing like every cent out of the window and like just hiring people for the sake of hiring people. We very much like attempted to hire the best possible people, and then like, you know, getting really the best talent on board. Instead of like hiring 10 people, we might hire like 3, and then we'll pay them a bit more. We'll get them more equity in the business. So we have like a highly concentrated set of highly qualified and talented people that can help accelerate the growth of the company, because ultimately more people means like more operational overhang, means, you know, you ultimately end up moving slower. So we've very much like taken that sort of like lean approach to growth, which I think has served us well, especially in a funding environment that has been somewhat challenged over the past couple of years.
And then also, how has it been to the dealing with the board, the corporate structure, making sure that people are aligned? How do you think now about board dynamics? You know, what can you share with the people listening as well?
We had a pretty small board for a long period of time. So CRV, our Series A and seed investor, have been on the board, and we've had some, you know, a fantastic board member from CRV that have been, I think, instrumental to getting to the company to where it is today. I think for the Series B, we've gotten another investor board, which of course meant up also getting another person on the board, which I think is great. It adds a lot of credibility to the company that you have a real board assembled. And it also just helps with offering like fresh perspectives on the various different types of problems that the business faces and like key decisions we have to make. And I think for us, like, we have really been focused on like getting the right people on the board, ultimately like getting a giving a board seat away to an investor, it's kind of like a marriage you can't get a divorce from. So you have to make sure that you get it right and you can work with these people for like many years going forward.
And then when it comes to problems, I mean, you were talking about problems earlier. Also, what have you learned about problem solving, you know, and really rallying the team around, you know, whatever is in front of you guys?
I think this is probably one of the main things that I've learned as a leader, that to solve problems in the business, you have to get insanely involved in the details of whatever problem that you're trying to solve. And then all the problems that may not be important or like may seem like they're important, but not important, you should just delegate. So that had really been the main learning for me. And we're still very much as founders involved in problem solving across the business. I'm still doing daily stand-ups with our sales team, our customer success team, with our solutions team to make sure that like we are focusing on the right things. Because I think as you scale, that really becomes the hardest part of building a company, because you lose that focus, you lose that alignment, and people start to like solve problems or try to attempt to solve problems that are not there.
So we're talking about people earlier. I want to just double click on that. You know, when it comes to people, you know, they're already, all of them, they're all betting on a vision, right? Whether it's investors, mm-hmm. customers, employees. So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Encore is fully realized, what does that world look like?
That's a great question and also a tough question. I think in that scenario, you never be like start to focus on like what's next. So, you know, our initial vision was to automate the data annotation process for computer vision. I think we managed to kind of achieve that within the first 12 to 18 months, or like leads to make meaningful progress on that, where like that ceased to be the main thing that we're focused on. And then we kind of like moved on to the next thing. So I think in a startup, right, if you're doing well, if you're doing stuff and if you're like growing in some dimension, there will always like be new problems to solve. And you will always like you reevaluate your vision and you focus on like what's next when certain things are achieved. And I think this is a very interesting thing actually, because I think ultimately like with big companies, right, that are not led by the founders anymore, that's something that they sometimes lose sight of, right? Where they stick to the initial vision, but they kind of forget all the stuff that's around, or like they fail to update their assumptions about the world, like move on from what the business was all about initially.
I love that. You know, there's actually a great book called Good to Great, Jim Collins, you know, and he really talks about the how businesses that have the founders leaving, you know, they lose the essence and how they decline, you know, over the course of time. So that's great that you mentioned that. And I guess we're talking about the future here. I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's mm-hmm. say I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, back to London. You know, back to maybe like 5 years ago when you were thinking about doing something of your own, you know, which obviously ended up becoming Encore. But let's say you had the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self and you have that younger Ulrich right there in front of you. And you're able to give that younger Ulrich one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
You know, people always tell you to be patient and, you know, wait for the right opportunity to come before like making the jump. And I think what I probably would have told myself is like, don't be patient. The earliest you start, the younger you are when you do it, the more shots you'll have at goal, the more shots you'll have at like finding something that actually works. So yeah, I would probably have started earlier if I could have.
And I think that as we're talking about learning here, how have you thought about really scaling yourself too, you know, to be able to scale at the same pace with the company so that the company doesn't outpace you? How have you thought about that too, the resources, the advisors, the people that you're surrounding yourself by as well in order to learn?
That's an incredible difficult thing, because, you know, you see your employees, sometimes they kind of like stop to scale once you hit certain milestones. They might be good at the 0-1 phase. They might be good at the 1-5 phase. As a founder, you don't really have that luxury. You kind of like have to continue to scale. Otherwise, you're going to probably get fired by the board, which of course is not the outcome that you want. I think the things you can do as a founder are meeting the right people, being in the sort of like social circles where you can discuss the various different types of problems and challenges you have in the business pretty openly. I think YC honestly is great for that, because it gives you that kind of peer network of people that you can like talk to and you can learn from. Of course, like not everybody has that luxury, so they have to find it elsewhere. But that's, you know, something that I think has been instrumental to at least my own personal growth, but also I think the company's growth, is that we have that network, we have the investors that we can ask for help from. You know, we have all of our advisors and all these things that you just shouldn't be afraid to ask for help, right? I think that's really what it comes down to. So you need to be able to be vulnerable and ask like the tough questions, even if you don't like hearing the answer.
I love it. So Ulrich, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So you can either go on our website on encore.com, that's encord.com, or just ping me directly on my email, which is Ulrich, U-L-R-I-K, at encore.com. And I'll make sure to get back to you.
Amazing. Well, hey, thank you so much, Ulrich. It has been an honor to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thanks, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.